Not Getting Lost. Transcription poems by Alan Sutherland from the words of Vicky Rayford Sinnott. First Memory. I grew up on a farm, a tiny farm, just outside a coal mining village in the northeast of England. My first vivid memory is of a foal being born in a stable and being very tiny. I probably was 18 months old, 2 years old, and taken in to see that. We were surrounded by horses. Horses weren't expensive things back in those days. Surrounded by all sorts of animals. So actually, a pattern of seeing animals born became a regular thing. I think for it to have had an impact, it must have been quite a moment. And there were a few of us in this tiny stable. So my grandfather, who had a massive impact on my life, and my dad was there, and my mum was there. It was very much a family moment, kind of establishing those farming roots. I feel very connected. In adulthood, I've never lived on a farm, but I kind of secretly would have liked to, in another parallel universe. I love the seasons. I love the fact that farmers grow things from the earth. I ultimately became a theatre director. But at that time, it was much cooler people than me that did drama. I didn't think that was part of my life, really. And certainly, growing up in a mining area in East Durham, the arts weren't really a feature. We might get an annual pantomime where we'd all cheer and boo. First Memory. I grew up on a farm, a tiny farm, just outside a coal mining village in the northeast of England. My first vivid memory is of a foal being born in a stable and being very tiny. I probably was 18 months old, 2 years old, and taken in to see that. We were surrounded by horses. Horses weren't expensive things back in those days. Surrounded by all sorts of animals. So actually a pattern of seeing animals born became a regular thing. I think for it to have had an impact, it must have been quite a moment. And there were a few of us in this tiny stable. So my grandfather, who had a massive impact on my life, and my dad was there, and my mum was there. It was very much a family moment, kind of establishing those farming roots. I feel very connected. In adulthood, I've never lived on a farm, but I kind of secretly would have liked to, in another parallel universe. I love the seasons. I love the fact that farmers grow things from the earth. Roots. I feel really rooted in that northeast perspective. Half of my family were farmers, and the other half of the family were miners. So they were very, very connected, I suppose, to the land and what was under it, in one way or another. So yeah, not quite the punk rock roots. I ended up as a punk in London somehow, but that's an interesting journey. I had in lots of ways a wonderful exposure to nature and the land. We weren't a particularly wealthy family. It was a tiny little farm and it subsidised the family. My grandfather had bought it, so it was a, you know, first and second generation farm. It wasn't like land inherited or anything like that. Went to a local comprehensive school in Peterlee, which is one of the 1960s new towns. Recently in the news for 1960s sculptural architecture. I think they're claiming it as heritage architecture these days. We used to smoke cigarettes and eat fish and chips on a lunchtime, you know, at school. We all thought it was pretty miserable, really. But they've got artists in doing amazing things, illuminating it and creating work in response to it. That all seems very strange and bizarre to the old, you know, the teenager in me. I did okay at school, and quite liked school in lots of ways. I ultimately became a theatre director, but at that time it was much cooler people than me that did drama. I didn't think that was part of my life, really. And certainly, growing up in a mining area in East Durham, the arts weren't really a feature. We might get an annual pantomime where we'd all cheer and boo. Roots. I feel really rooted in that northeast perspective. Half of my family were farmers, and the other half of the family were miners. So they were very, very connected, I suppose, to the land and what was under it, in one way or another. So yeah, not quite the punk rock roots. I ended up as a punk in London somehow, but that's an interesting journey. I had in lots of ways a wonderful exposure to nature and the land. We weren't a particularly wealthy family. It was a tiny little farm, and it subsidised the family. My grandfather had bought it, so it was a, you know, first and second generation farm. It wasn't like land inherited or anything like that. Went to a local comprehensive school in Peterlee, which is one of the 1960s new towns. Recently in the news for 1960s sculptural architecture. I think they're claiming it as heritage architecture these days. We used to smoke cigarettes and eat fish and chips on a lunchtime, you know, at school. We all thought it was pretty miserable, really. But they've got artists in doing amazing things, illuminating it and creating work in response to it. That all seems very strange and bizarre to the old, you know, the teenager in me. I did okay at school and quite liked school in lots of ways. I ultimately became a theatre director, but at that time, it was much cooler people than me that did drama. I didn't think that was part of my life, really. And certainly, growing up in a mining area in East Durham, the arts weren't really a feature. We might get an annual pantomime where we'd all cheer and boo. The biggest artistic impact for me was punk rock. Life felt drab. And then punk hit and gosh, the costumes, the fashion, the uniform of punk in a tiny pit village. At 16, I started designing clothes for a punk shop in Durham and sold them under the label of Spider, which I thought was very punk rock at the time. I had a trademark little spider that I would draw on my face, quite goth sort of look. Me and my best friend, who is my best friend to this day, we'd parade these fashions through the pit village, and people would shout things like, "The freaks are out tonight!" And yeah, we'd quite like that, really, I think. That was something about feeling a bit different. So at this age, I'm not identifying as disabled. That didn't come till later in my life. You know that I would identify around mental health. But I do know that my mental health problem started for certain. I can trace them back to when I was about 7. Things started to manifest themselves. The sound of silence. My grandfather, who had bought the farm, developed quite serious mental health problems himself. He'd had a compulsory purchase order from a local council, been kicked off his farm. You know, it wasn't good. It wasn't good, and sadly, he took his life in a psychiatric hospital. And as kids, we weren't told that that was what had happened. We were told he had died. But everybody else in the village knew what had happened, because it was reported in the newspapers. So we'd get versions of it as kids from school bullies. And actually, that had quite an impact, that there was this bizarre silence and secret, but that everybody else knew something. It was a very strange position to be in. So I definitely developed anxiety and an eating disorder at that age. The eating disorder was a secret thing. It started quite gently, as they usually do. And then it progressed throughout my teens, and then throughout my life. I think at 7 I knew there was something different happening with me, but I couldn't have begun to label it or articulate it. In teenage years, I did the thing that teenage girls do and worry about their bodies. But I also had a very serious period of anxiety and mental health distress, which it wasn't something that you'd reach out, or I didn't reach out, for help. It was something that I very much internalized. In some ways, that played itself out through punk, drinking quite a lot, which lots of teenagers do, so it's not detected, if you know what I mean. It's kind of disguised, and you self-medicate and try to get through it. London. I thought the streets were paved with punk gold. So me and my best friend, we moved to London and lived a furious year on about 2 hours sleep a night. Every punk event that we could go to or find, and we'd spend all Saturday on the King's Road and Carnaby Street, and we'd be in underground clubs like the Catacomb or Jean-Pierre's. We loved Jean-Pierre's because you could take your own booze, so it was neat Bacardi for maximum effect. I hadn't needed to be hospitalised or had to have any interventions. Metamorphosis. I think we'd been in London for about a year. Then I saw a play called Metamorphosis by Stephen Burkoff with Tim Roth in the lead. And it blew my mind. You know, now, this me, I know there's lots of problems with the work of Stephen Burkoff. We could critique it and all of that. But then, to somebody who'd come from a pit village and a little farm, I'd experimented with the theatre of punk, and then this piece of work, my goodness me, I'd no idea that you could tell a story visually, poetically. And not long after that, I saw a piece of work by Adele Salim, Seven Seas, which is a two-hander feminist piece of work, and it equally blew my mind in terms of identity, politics. Similarly with the Burkoff piece, it felt edgy and political. So I couldn't eat enough theatre, went to see Timothy Spall, early Complicité stuff. Big, visual, stylized theatre was really saying something to me. I could see that it was going to be possible to tell stories in that way for me. And the other thing was, I think parallel to my mental health, I had begun to write by the time I was in London. So I was writing mainly poetry at that time, quite awkward, teenage political stuff, but I've great affection for it. I realised that I felt we had to tell stories this way, the Shakespeare, the Dickens, a pretty Aristotelian structure. My mind definitely didn't think in that way. I didn't experience life in that way, very staccato, episodic. And, well, probably like many of us, but you know, I don't write in a linear way. And so to see pieces of work that I thought, actually, it's fine to challenge form. And to challenge what the status quo has been presenting us with for such a long time. Quite quickly, I knew I wanted an opportunity to make political work, and I was thinking along feminist lines. Between 15 and punk, and 17 and 18 and moving to London, I'd become really quite politicised. A-levels. I would have been 19, 20, had a bit of a heady time in London. I'd worked with kids to earn a living. I'd worked as a nanny, survived on a 2 hours sleep a night. And then I thought, actually, I really want to try theatre. I think there's something there for me. And so I put myself through A-levels, English literature and drama and theatre studies. And fortunately, I got a lecturer called Christine Harmer Brown, who was also a brilliant facilitator. And again, she was pretty in tune with that Bukovian, you know, all the new stuff that was happening and new interpretations of Brecht's theories, which have gone on to inform my own work. How do we make those what I think are really amazing theatrical theories and practices? How do we make them contemporary and relevant, make them live and breathe? That's a lifelong passion for me. Because I think it's how we, as a disability community, can signify our identities. So then I did really well in my A-level. Unraveling. University was a brilliant adventure. It was a 4-year degree. It was a time that my mental health started to unravel a little bit. I spent a lot of time dissociating but concealing it, so it wasn't getting to crisis level. I think it had gently been building. I also think I felt a bit of a fraud pants, if I'm honest. There's a thing lots of us experience. So mine would be that, well, I'm from a tiny pit village in the northeast of England. What am I doing? Who do I think I am? To go and do a 4-year experimental drama degree. I don't mean I articulated that in that way, but I think inside there was just, an inferiority thing, a self-esteem thing, which probably stemmed back and related to the eating disorder and, you know, the early crises that I'd gone through with my grandfather's death. So I think there was a build. And it combined with not really feeling part of anything. And then the other side of that is, I don't really know chemically what was happening. I still don't fully understand that, how that all works. I would describe myself as a system avoider. Some people call themselves system survivors. I did lots of things to avoid contact, connection, help. I realised that that means that I was luckier than lots of people because I hadn't hit the complete trauma point. I had a couple of those in later life, but I was somehow getting through it. Residency. I got through the degree. For 3 years of it, I probably wasn't terribly well. But I loved what I was having the opportunity to do. So we did acting, we did set design, stage technology. And then I specialised in directing in my final year. I graduated in 92 and the environment of Kent at that time was quite experimental, contemporary and political. So I was introduced to feminist theatre. And that was the real way into understanding about the construction of identity. So I looked at how gender was constructed before I looked at how disability was constructed. But I think because I'd been able to do that, once you know those things, or once you've seen those things, or explored them, then you realise, oh wow, there's a whole world view, depending on whether you believe in it or not, but I firmly do. You know, societally, we're constructing identity all the time. And we are fortunate enough to have inherited 2,000 years of crap. Even then, I wasn't entering the mental health world or a disability world. I came home to the Northeast and set up a theatre company, feminist theatre company, in East Durham. So I actually went back to my home area. I think I set up the company in 93. And people were, who I went to university with, like, what are you doing? Why are you going to the Northeast to do feminist theatre? And why in County Durham? And within 3 months, we had a year-long residency in the local college. So actually, we were there. I mean, it was a revelation, but it was wonderful. We were welcomed with open arms. That residency was my first introduction to disability arts. I'd never heard of it at university. Disability theatre had never come up. The theatre company went for about 7 years in the northeast of England. I worked with learning disabled women for a lot of that time. We'd get invited in and out of some of the National Disability Arts Forum stuff. But obviously, I wasn't identifying as a disabled person. Moving On. I began to work with Moving On, a group of learning disabled women who wanted to explore women's voices, which in 92, that was quite early days in learning disability, looking at gender. They were really quickly programmed because they were amazing, these women. Very vocal, visual, funny. And they were based in both Hartlepool and Peterlee. My first encounter with disability arts was with a woman called Sue Vass. She was on the cabaret scene. She did a character called Mavis Dishcloth. She was with National Disability Arts Forum. Sue Vass, as part of her remit, she covered County Durham, and so she would programme some of these events, which is the first time that I saw Ian Stanton. And he was playing in Spennymoor in County Durham, and The Fugitives were on the bill. So that was Karen Sheeder, a stalwart of disability arts in the Northeast, part of Shoot Your Mouth Off film company to this day. She became chair of Arcadia, which was the Northern Disability Arts Forum. So I had a close working relationship with her eventually. But that came later. Deadly Devotchka. Deadly Devotchka was the show that I took to Edinburgh, which looked at femme fatale and film noir and stereotypes of women. I had 16mm film in that. This was pre-digital age. That was actually quite thrilling. We shot elements of it in County Durham and then sent it off to be developed. It was quite exciting when it came back. And then I wasn't very well. When we came back from Edinburgh, I started to think. I mean, I internalised it and thought there was something really wrong with me. I didn't understand what was happening. Because I've had amazing support, I was able to hide the mental health stuff for quite a long time. And it's funny, because as I think about it now, even though my mum was a psychiatric nurse, I don't know if that's what made me think it happened to other people and not me. I don't know. I really don't know. Very Special Arts. So then a job came up in Ireland. I always describe this with great embarrassment, but it was Very Special Arts in Dublin. And I think because I wasn't politicised in a disability context, I didn't know the language. It's not that I thought that I was great. Please don't think that I did, because I didn't. And one of the first jobs I did was change the name. But it was the beginning then. So I went to Dublin and met artists like Rosaline McDonough, Donald Tolan, Porrig Norton, Steve Daunt, Peter Kearns and Yvonne Lynch. Donald was a figurehead for the disability rights movement in Ireland. Himself, Martin Norton, Hubert McCormack, and fortunately he was a brilliant actor. He actually came and worked with Grey Eye. He did Bent with them. Very early on, I was connected with phenomenal disabled artists and actually working with them. I began to realise that mental health was part of disability. By this point in Ireland, I was engaging with the system. I needed more help than I had before, and so I was getting treatment, counselling, medication. And so I was processing that in a way, alongside this amazing experience we all had. I was appointed in 99, and I was in Dublin till 2003. And initially there was no framework, there was nothing. There was Very Special Arts, which had been set up by Jean Kennedy Smith, JFK's sister. Jean Kennedy Smith set up Very Special Arts. She'd been the American ambassador in Ireland, so this was her baby. She'd set it up when she was there, but it had a very paternalistic model of practice. It was based at the City Arts Centre, I remember, when I first rolled up in my job as CEO, but anyway, these artists were clearly activists. There was no legislation protecting disabled people at that time in Ireland. Donal was a very visible advocate. He was quite often on television. He often had audiences with the President of Ireland, and he was highly regarded and highly respected. We decided, as a group of activists and artists, that cabaret was our way forward. But what we did was we devised, it was a whole show. So it wasn't that a series of acts would turn up, not that there's anything wrong with that, and do their bit. The whole thing was written so that every act there was an element that had been created especially for this show. The amazing thing was that so many doors were open to us artistically. The Arts Council of Ireland wanted to fund it, and mainstream venues wanted to programme it. We did one in City Arts Centre. It sold out, and it was a raucous night. It was brilliant. And the thing I can liken it to is LGBT cabarets that have a feel to them, that have a community sense of everybody's in on it, pulling for it, and they get these characters. We'd achieved that around disability, so it was a completely fresh way of looking at disability in an Irish context. That had already started here, obviously. But we were booked into places like City Arts Centre, into Project Arts Centre. And quite quickly, artists were then getting commissions from mainstream venues. And we tried to wrestle Very Special Arts from Jean Kennedy Smith in a very uncomfortable meeting in a hotel in Dublin. And she really did try to treat me like a child, which didn't go down very well. And she said to my, I had an assistant with me, and she said to her at one point, run along, dear. And I said, she's not going anywhere. And you know, you can imagine she wasn't comfortable with the self-advocacy element and self-determination of disability because of where she was coming from. But what did happen was we were able to change the name. And what the artist decided on was Art and Disability Ireland. And that is the name. They wanted the name of the country in it. And they wanted it to have a certain gravitas around a name, rather than a creative name. It was to give it a status of influence, and to let people know that this group of people were serious about making change. Obviously, arts and disability is quite a different thing here. But I note even now that that's the name they've stuck with. It's a less political organisation. I admire it hugely, but I don't think it's a very political organisation. To me, it appears to be more about access and making established mainstream work accessible to disabled audiences. So it's quite different to where we were back then. There was a real buzz around it. We felt we'd taken ownership of the organisation, and the artists became the board. So they replaced the great and the good. And so it became a self-led, disabled-led organisation. And then I mentored and directed two of the first pieces of disability theatre in the Republic of Ireland. The Baby Doll Project. Rosaline McDonough wrote The Baby Doll Project. She's a traveller woman who's also disabled. She wrote about the institutionalization of traveller women and of disabled traveller women. It was quite explosive, because in the traveller community, women do not perform, do not go on stage. So Rosaline's been a figurehead in Ireland for the last 20 years now, both as a playwright and as somebody campaigning for traveller women's rights. She's a phenomenal woman. Her play was well received. It toured Ireland, it was the first of its kind, and it won a Met Aaron Award. I think that was quite something. We didn't feel like we were having to scrabble around the edges. We'd like to do this. Yes, you can. Here's some money. Don't know if it's just because it's a small country, and I suppose they knew something had to happen. And then I also devised a piece with Donald called Broadcast, which was commissioned as part of the Dublin Fringe. Again, another unheard-of scenario. And it was a one-man show for him, great vehicle for him. And it was a genuinely multimedia piece, not a 16mm. We did digital by this time. So then lots of things started to build for those artists, and people were commissioning them. Rosaline's gone on. She's worked with the Abbey Theatre, which is their national theatre, and with Fish Amble Theatre Company. She's had commissions and work in development here at the Royal Court and at the National. Nothing that's made the stage yet, but nevertheless her career has grown. Donald, before he died, made many more appearances in artistic contexts. There were some incredible, incredibly fierce activists, brilliant forward-thinking people like Mary Duffy, you know, another legend, who really were forces for change. I came home eventually, because my little boy was going to start school. So we came back home, back to the northeast of England. When I was first appointed at Art Disability Ireland, some people were very disappointed that I was English. Some people were very disappointed that I was a woman and didn't hold back. Some people were very disappointed that I wasn't an identifying disabled person, which I absolutely get now. So it wasn't all plain sailing. There was resistance. I genuinely had to forge relationships with people. Peter Kearns and Yvonne Lynch became really solid, but at first they were the two people that had the biggest question marks and really distanced themselves. And I can remember the first time that I came out to one of this group of people. I won't name them, but it was a really difficult conversation. We'd had lots of conversations. We'd talked about my mental health. We talked about suicidal ideations that I'd had. We talked about attempts that I'd made. It was unquestionable that they knew. Whether they thought that mental health was a category under disability or not, I don't know. But it was a really awful, difficult conversation. I was saying, I think, that I more and more identify as a disabled person, because of the barriers that I was experiencing. The boards that I'd worked for initially were predominantly non-disabled people from a very paternalistic perspective. They said, you know, you don't have to do this. You don't have to identify as a disabled person. It was very odd. It felt like a coming out conversation that I was moving from one place to another. And then I didn't feel supported. But I get that. I understand why that might have been. I think there's a thing with people who've been disabled from birth and have been institutionalised and who have had an atrocious experience, which is not the experience that I've had, obviously. I haven't come from an institutionalised background. And so there is a different experience that we had. I'm aware of some of the tensions around that, and that's cropped up a few times about whether you're really, are you really disabled? This happens in our community, in the disability community. I didn't stride out saying I'm non-disabled, but clearly I was in that position in a disability organisation that should have been disabled-led. And then, while I'm there, I come out as disabled. It wasn't a good experience with the board. There were some difficulties. Maybe that's what I'll say about it. Arcadia. By a complete fluke, they were looking for a director for Nordaf, as they were at that time. And so I was interviewed by members of the board, some of whom were disabled people and some of whom weren't. Got the job, I had to see out a bit of maternity leave, and there was a bit of disquiet about that. Although I actually went back to work really early after my daughter was born. Yeah, there was a bit of, you know, local conversation about that. The Arts Council in the Northeast was a rocky relationship. It was at a time that diversity was well and truly on the agenda. It was a time that Sue Williams and Tony Panayiotou were at National Office, were bringing disabled people into conversations. And then the goalposts shifted, I think, internally and policy-wise. But the Northeast wasn't as supportive as the national picture. Keep on knocking. I arrived full of positivity and determination and fight. The Northeast of England actually had a lot more disabled artists. Well, it's more highly populated, probably, even than the whole of Ireland is. There were a lot more venues. It was quite a big job to support artists and create platforms for them to be supported and to create work, and then to do the persuading, you know, the campaigning, the knocking on doors, the outrage at inaccessibility. And there weren't many open doors at all, there really weren't. It took a long time to get away into Northern Stage, for example, which is the regional theatre, where you'd expect theatre work to be shared. So we had a long-term campaign with, well, relationship building. But it was a campaign from our point of view. The Sage Gateshead at that time, brand new building, and I can remember being invited as director of Arcadia to go and, you know, and they showed me about 27 toilets, accessible toilets. That's what they wanted to show me. I thought they wanted to say, can you suggest some disabled musicians who could come and play in our marvellous halls? They actually called us extremists because we wanted to challenge the language that they were using around disability. And I wish I'd kept that email, but there was an angry, a terse email saying, we're not going to engage with the language of extremists. And the Arts Council weren't there for us in those kind of conversations. The right to fail. Why is there an expectation that the work of disabled people has got to be 100% perfect? It's got to hit many more targets in terms of quality than anyone else. A lot of art is about the right to fail. And many artists are allowed to fail. But when it comes to disability or other groups within diversity, sorry, you've got to hit those heady heights or your validity's called into question. I'd arrived with lots of fight. My first article for Nordaf News was Tearing Down the Temples, looking at these institutions who just were archaic in their attitudes, not just to disabled people, but just preserving that ugly status quo. Arcadia Ambassadors. And then we had an ambassadors scheme, where we brought people like Joe Verran, Susie Balderston, Julie McNamara was one of our ambassadors. Caroline Boditz was another ambassador. Actually, she became our ambassador to Northern States. And what we'd created, and what we had the funding for, was 9 luxurious days of consultation in the venues. The ambassadors would go into, I think it was New Writing North, a print works, Northern Stage, and, you know, observe, look at their policies, look at their programs. And it was quite shocking at the time what the research discovered in terms of just, there was nothing. There was no awareness of accessibility, even though it had been enshrined in law for about 10 years by that point. We had an excellent 2-year development program, which was funded by Esme Fairbairn, and that supported lots of artists to make work. We partnered artists with mentors in venues. And so it was the building blocks, I suppose, of where we got to. Wear and tear. I was with Agadir for just over 6 years. We had the Mimosa Festival, a month-long festival across the northeast, which felt like a massive achievement. We brought artists from all over the country to showcase, as obviously LDAF's festivals in London had done, and Dada Fest was doing. But the fight with the Arts Council got harder and harder. I think after about 3 years, I felt quite worn down by that. There wasn't a lot of space for them to support us to do new things. And internally, they were coming up with lots of extra administrative things for RFOs to do. And we were tiny. So I was CEO, but I was also delivering. I was artistic director of the festival. And we had 2 staff, 2 full-time posts that were kind of shared out a little bit. It was quite hard going, but we did have a massive community of people and a massive group of artists who would benefit from the magazines, which were quarterly and then became monthly. And they would contribute to those, get information from those. And there were lots of artistic activities, you know, all of the time. We had an active network so people didn't feel isolated. And I left Arcadia about 1.5 years before they were disinvested. Disinvested. By the 6th year, I was never going to work in the arts again. I'd had it. I went and baked cakes for 1 year. Yeah, I was totally, totally burnt out. And it was, you know, you'd get to the stage where your stomach would just drop at an email. Another email from the Arts Council. Because I was so unwell, I didn't really keep in touch with what was happening very much. Karen Sheeder, who I mentioned before, part of the Fugitives, was the chair of Arcadia at that time, a brilliant chair. And she oversaw it. She fought for those artists. You know, that massive community of people. I lasted about 1 year baking cakes. And then I knew I wanted to go back to my own practice of making theatre. By then, Arcadia had gone. And that whole network of artists had largely disappeared. And you can count. There's a bigger community now, but when I came back in about 2011-12, you could probably count on both hands how many artists, disabled artists, were still practicing. In the Northeast, their sole support system was gone. People did have these valiant attempts at keeping things together, but if the money's not there to pay for access, to pay travel support for people, they're just not going to get together. And that's pretty much the picture. We've lost people along the way, as we do inevitably, but it feels I'm not defeated by it, and there's a lot of new artists coming up and realising they can have voices about this stuff, and they're coming from very different perspectives. And that's really interesting and inspiring, and what they're saying is thought-provoking and making me think I might be stuck in a rut here. Or should I be thinking about this differently? You know, I have got some pretty strongly held beliefs around the social model and how useful it is still, even in terms of thinking about the content of work, of helping venues to understand. You know, we can turn it around and ask them to look at content, characters, stereotypes and tropes. And it's useful to connect that to the social model, the way we historically view disability. I still think that that's invaluable to us at this time. Cultural shift. I did a 3-year project in ARC in Stockton called Cultural Shift, which is something I'm immensely proud of. It was a strategic artistic project. It had the social model at its heart, and it had art at its heart. So first and foremost, it was an artistic project, and ARC were totally up for that. They didn't see disability as an add-on. They didn't see access as an add-on. They wanted to look at how they could embed it in their own work. And so in terms of getting them to understand the history, the cultural experience, the cultural representation of disabled people, the social model was a brilliant way to explain that. We'd probably call it disability equality training, but I think those sessions are so much more than training. Because we're not telling people how to install a lift or a ramp or whatever. It's much bigger than that. And it's to change the misinformation that's gone on for 2,000 years about disability. How to try and get inside their hearts and heads and really shift thinking and beliefs. I think once we do start talking with organisations about the type of work they're programming and the stories they're happy to tell, and we can relate that then back to the stereotypes it's been possible to identify, in part through the thinking of the social model and the tropes that retell and rehash these shadows of people's lives, we're always a secondary character, we're always a device, we're always there to further somebody else's story or to be the butt of jokes or whatever. It was really interesting working that through with the programming team at ARC. Literally, you could see pennies dropping. They believe. They want to see really good quality, interesting work that's challenging the world today. Once you start to point out, well, that's an amazing piece of contemporary work, but what do you think about this take on it? Once you see the pennies dropping, and they said something really brilliant, which was, and they say it to this day, oh my God, once you know this, you can't not know it. In terms of what you're happy to then commission, program, and that needs to be across the arts, the model that we developed, I'd love to see that. It would have so much more impact than the things like the creative case. I would say that, wouldn't I? So I think from that point of view, it has informed and influenced. And then ARC are brilliant, because they're part of lots of networks of other arts centres, and they are very influential. And I think, actually, in the disability arts community, they've become a bit of a beacon of hope, certainly for theatre makers, because they support so many. And now lots of disabled artists are applying to ARC to come and do a residency, which is fantastic. ARC are programming at least 3 pieces of disabled-led work every season. A lot of disability theatre and performance is being programmed there. And so they are a role model who I'm really proud of them. Criteria. I'm the best police force for my own work. As an artist, I don't know what it's like for other artists, but there's a bit of a wrestling match goes on in the producing of a play, the writing of a play, for me. And so there are a number of criteria that I want to see in my own work. I'm interested in a disability aesthetic, if such a thing exists. Whether it's one thing, variable things, or multiple things. And I obviously am very conscious of not perpetuating any of the old myths. And I worry about that, because I think it's so ingrained in our culture. We even have to be really careful that we're not falling into the trap of telling the old stories. And so that's why I'm doing my PhD now. I'm not interested in the PhD, I want the testing ground. I want the space to really think about these things and whether we have got an aesthetic. And also if it's actually possible to change the way people think about disability. How possible is that with a piece of theatre? So in that live situation, am I only ever going to perform to the converted? There's hundreds of questions there, but that sort of thing nourishes me and keeps me awake at night and keeps me making work. The art of not getting lost. The first piece of theatre I made, coming back to my practice when I set up Little Cog, was called The Art of Not Getting Lost. And it was, in a way, that typical, almost like going back to the beginning. You know, the first piece of work an artist makes, looking very much at their own world. It wasn't autobiographical, but it was very much of a mental health perspective. It was two characters who were called Everyone and No One. And they had holed themselves up in a disused underground station, where they were collecting objects and artifacts from the history of disabled people and cataloguing them. So some of them were very obvious things that would relate to disabled people who were used as Hitler's first experiments for the final solution. And that, yeah, it's been used a lot, and I think people are a bit cynical about how much it gets used. But for me, we're so close to that. We're so close to that eugenic. In fact, we're probably closer in our thinking to that now as a nation, not as individual people. It's a story that still needs to be told and explored and explained and correlations made. But what I do is dip in and out of history. So I'm quite interested in reclaiming historical characters. Now, I didn't do that in The Art of Not Getting Lost. There weren't specific characters that they re-embodied. But it did look at the development of stigma around mental health. And obviously a lot of what Churchill said in the 1920s was hugely influential on legislation here. And so I looked at that and how that's informed our attitudes around mental health and institutionalisation. But these two characters, Everyone and No One, were, I hope, phenomenally lively, vibrant, funny, moving characters. All of the set was on wheels, and they constantly shifted the space and moved, and they had a desk, and they had filing cabinets full of objects. They had shelving units full of things, and they'd constantly reconfigure the space to make new rooms or to tell new stories. I was really pleased with it as a piece of work, and it did catch people's imaginations. Because it was my first show back, and because I was recovering, I was in a period of recovery. I didn't then do a lot with it. It was in two venues, and that was it. But I felt like Ark then became a partner and became my producer. And I couldn't believe that. I approached Annabelle, who's the director at Ark, and said, "Will you give me support to make this piece of work?" I thought there'd be all sorts of conditions attached to it. I'd have to prove myself. And she said, "Yeah, what can I give you?" And I was like, "Me?" That is hugely nourishing for an artist, to be supported in that way. Then the support became much bigger, and we developed a mutual relationship, where I and what I did was obviously as beneficial to them in lots of ways as they were to me. And I think we did develop a hugely kind of unique relationship. The art of not getting lost touched on the butterfly effect, which in the most basic terms of chaos theory is that one action can cause a major reaction and one person can effect the biggest change. So I wanted to look more into the mathematics of the butterfly effect, and the next play was a one-woman show called Butterfly. Butterfly. It looked further into mental health. It reclaimed specific characters from history. So we had Boudica. The only thing we know about Boudica, or Boadicea as some people call her, was written by Roman men. So we never ever heard anything in her voice. So part of it was giving her a voice. We know she had mental health problems, and we know she died of dementia. Not in the moulds that we are, but she was a disabled woman in history who was really, really interesting. So I reclaimed her, good bit of fight, and then had a character called Beatrice, who was a modern-day character who was waiting for a mental health assessment. And she basically played out all these other characters. So I had a character called Barbara from ancient Rome, Mary, who was from the witch hunts. It was constantly between Beatrice going between these characters, and then we had Butterfly, who was another character, who traced the story, basically made all the connections. By then, I was feeling much more confident. Did a national tour, Annabelle produced it, and it got Best One-Person Play from the British Theatre Guide. Full Circle Theatre Company. Another part of my practice, which has an equal weighting, is that I work with a company of learning disabled adults 2 days a week, who are based at ARC, who are now a professional independent theatre company. When I first met them, they were a day services project, but they wanted freedom. So they got it, and Arts Council have supported us with that. They've been making work for 10 years. We've made 5 pieces of work together. Big, visual, non-verbal pieces, usually. Although we find ways to thread a narrative through it. They sell out when they're on at ARC, and where we are now is they wanted to tour, obviously. With the constraints of day services, previously that was a no-no. But now they're free. Oh yeah, we're touring. So we built relationships with different venues in the north, and we're going to do that first, and then take over the world after that. That's as interesting to me as making my own work, is working with other people. Occupation. And then I've directed shows by Pauline Heath. Occupation was 4 professional actors and a community cast of 15, which was quite a big production at ARC. It was set on the day of a protest around a self-built monument in the middle of the town. and it was about how austerity had affected primarily disabled people, but also Pauline wanted to give voice to the mother of a disabled child. And that was a fantastic piece of work because the general community got so involved with it. That went down a storm and it was on the main stage. So yeah, it's good to be able to make quite political work, but find ways to make it feel really juicy and community orientated and like it's a good night out. I think that's another aspect of the work, is you want people to feel they've come and experienced something. That's something that me and Pauline talk about. We want people engaged and involved, and that's certainly one of the things I'm interested in. How do we give audiences agency over the stuff we're telling them? It's not enough to just give them the information around disability. We have to somehow find ways to give them agency. That's a lifelong mission, again. Other playwrights have done it. Other playwrights have brought about social change. I'm constantly looking at how other people do that. What is it about disability? What is it about disability that people are terrified of talking about still? That's one of the big questions for me. Similar in theatre. And I think we know it's connected to that deficit perception, the model of thinking that disability is deficient, as all groups who are regarded as other, but I think particularly around disability. And audiences are not expecting to see anything that relates to them. They're not expecting to see anything that relates to humanity or how people relate to each other. And it's funny, there's a real shift in new writing particularly, which I'm so frustrated by, because we seem to have gone back to human interest. It's tabloid theatre. I feel sad that young artists particularly are being encouraged to make that sort of work. So they're sort of selling tickets to their trauma and not really being supported or knowing what the context or the possible bigger context is that they're making their work in. That thing about human interest, and it's like we can't tell very big stories unless we're David Hare at the National Theatre. And it seems to be that there's a real move back to, I could be wrong about this, and it's based on what I get to see, but real move back to those old three-act plays. They might be told in a very modern way, but the old structure and the form remain. Whereas I think a lot of disability theatre has really challenged that, as has black theatre. So that remains a source of frustration. In or out? Sometimes you feel part of the gang and at other times not. And there are lots of reasons for that, which might be geographic, they might be impairment specific, they might be how long you've been connected to the movement. It's funny the stage we're at with the movement. Disability rights and disability arts and the generational change. I'm fascinated by that. This younger generation of disabled artists who might not describe themselves in that way and might not want to be described in that way, but are making work about impairment. Another England. Another England was the play that I toured most recently. It was a two-hander and Andrew McLay was in it and Philippa Griffiths. Philippa Cole is her stage name. Two brilliant, brilliant actors. And I decided with that piece, it's very political, but it was powerful and beautiful. And I'm saying that in an embarrassed way, I wouldn't talk about my work, but I aimed for those things, and audiences seemed to respond really well to it. I really was pushing for the National Theatre to come and see it. And they did. I couldn't believe it. Somebody had recommended me as a director, a regional director to the National. So they, ironically, had asked to meet me before the show toured. So it's just like serendipity. In fact, they asked me to consider assistant directing on a show next year. But I can't move to London for 5 months. I'd said to them that really wasn't what I was looking for. But that felt like a major breakthrough. I'd met them at this meeting, and we'd had probably just a half an hour informal friendly meeting. And I thought maybe that was it. I invited them to the show, and they came to the show. What she'd taken from the show was quite genuine, and she chatted for ages. And that's when I was offered this other thing. And now I've been invited to make a proposal, which could be a tiny thing, might come to nothing. It might be an acorn, it might blossom, you never know. Ever hopeful. But the other thing is I'm talking to the Royal Court, and not just about myself as a writer. I think they really need to do something around disabled playwrights. And not just another initiative where we get to go and have a course for a year and there's nothing at the end of it. We're always learning. We must be masters at everything because we're always on courses. As an artist, you're always a campaigner and an educator as well. Useless Fucker. I'm writing my new play at the moment called Useless Fucker, which is its working title. We don't know if any theatres will take it. It represents a departure, in a way, from some of the work I've been making, and I've got much bigger plans for it. I brought in a dramaturge to support me to look at new ways of writing. I'll tell you where the story comes from, which is personal, and so obviously it's going to have to morph into something else. My dad, at 55, overnight, went from being a strapping farmer to somebody who'd suffered a catastrophic stroke. He changed overnight. He was still the same him in there, but obviously it changed his life. And he was determined to forge on with the life he'd had before. Who wouldn't? He was still the same person, but had lost the use of his left-hand side. But his life wasn't about loss. A few weeks into this recovery, he needed a part for the combine harvester, and my partner drove him to somewhere that he could get the part, where he'd been going to buy parts for 40 years. Somebody who recognised him 6 weeks previously did not now recognise him, didn't see him as the same person. And this guy asked my dad a question that he couldn't instantly answer. And obviously his speech was affected, and the guy was really frustrated, turned away and said, "Useless fucker." Which is a description that has probably been applied to lots of us behind our backs. That's a really painful memory, and how dare that fucker say that? "Useless fucker" is such a dismissive way to describe another human being. It totally relates to our status in the national psyche. And so what was a very derogatory term, which I want to explore, also the term fucker, could be a bit playful. It's about fucking with people. It's about becoming a bit of a fucker, mischief maker. And so that was the survival in reality for my dad. But he didn't give a shit. He drove with one hand before he got his license back. He was out in the tractor with a big digger on the front of it. He was out on the combine harvester, driving it with one hand. Now, some people might say that's denial. Who cares? He was doing what he wanted to do. But there were all sorts of things that happened. He was in danger of losing the farm. He was £500,000 in debt. You know, there was all sorts of stuff. So then I fictionalise all this. And there's a really interesting story about the north of England. There's an interesting story about what happens when you are one thing one day and something else the next. What happens when you become a useless fucker? We know the figures. At least 70% of people will become disabled in their lifetimes. So why are we terrified to discuss it? And so this piece is looking at that and what happens to somebody. Not the tragedy of it, because my dad never saw it as a tragedy. My mum did, but my dad didn't. He preserved his sense of self. He mucked about, he got pissed, he told fart jokes, he was still his same self. There is an unravelling in the play, that it's not the story of the family. And it won't become that trope where, oh my goodness, there's been a disaster, this is how the family fall apart. But there is an unravelling of the roles and identity. In the same way that Frank, fictional name, has to address his new identity and who his new friends become and who is his confidant. And it's about common threads and removing the two dimensions that we see. It's about taking ownership of the so-called recovery, you know. That's what it is described as in occupational health. There's no occupational therapy terms, but that is, it's not that I'm interested in. It's how Frank adapted his sense of self, and it wasn't a tragedy. Edge. There is quite a brutal edge to the story. It is set in the northeast of England, so it's a northeastern voice. I have to be true to that voice, which I haven't always used. I have used a disabled voice, a disabled woman's voice, but this is a northeast voice particularly. I'm interested in the notion of violence around disability, the cruelty and the brutality that we see every day now, unfortunately. Whether it's a casual insult on the street, which cuts so deep, to family relationships that are far from perfect, to actual physical violence. There's an element of that, because it's such a part of the language of some people in the Northeast around difference. There is quite an exploration of what that violence, with a very small v initially, means around disability, which is very much of our times, I think. Pertinent. A different vehicle. Quite a lot of my work is inevitably quite dark. I find humour at times, and I think an audience needs moments of levity. And, you know, it can't be an onslaught. My dramaturg, I worked with Jonathan Meth, who actually has got a lot of connections with disabled playwrights over the years, said I had to write this as a comedy somehow. And I know what he meant by that, in the sense that it's not a laugh-out-loud, uproarious farce or anything, but it's a different way to talk about, it's a different vehicle for the messages. I'm always seeking different vehicles for our message. Q&A. When I toured Another England, we had a Q&A after every performance, and at least 80% of the audience would stay. And we'd have a really informal chat. We weren't sitting on a panel on a stage, we'd all go into the bar or somewhere. And one of the ones in London lasted longer than the show. It was such a hunger for people. And it wasn't exclusively disabled people who'd come to see it. But for disabled people particularly to see their own stories or the experiences they were having or an artistic take on it. And they just wanted to, loved being together and talking. You know, talking and different perspectives. And we experienced that everywhere we went. There's a hunger. There's a need.